It's a pleasure to welcome all of you this evening at our JEP Identity Lecture. And it's a delight to be at the home of Harvey and Harvey Ann Ross. Harvey and Harvey and Harvey Ann. Harvey and Harvey Ann have been very, very dear friends of JEP. We've developed a very, very close relationship. And one of the things that I've noticed about both of them is that they are both eager to share inspiration and knowledge about Judaism with their fellow Jew. And that accounts for our being here tonight. And we certainly hope and pray that our gathering tonight will be a source of blessing to both of them for many, many years of very wonderful health and genuine happiness. Tonight's lecture is a memorial lecture, the Nathan and Lena Seiler Memorial Lecture. Nathan and Lena Seiler were the parents of Rebbetzin Zahava Deitch. For many of you here, that name rings a very loud bell, because the late husband of Rebbetzin Zahava Deitch, Rabbi Yaakov Deitch, was like a brother to me. I never had a real brother. He was the closest that I got. And he was my partner in co-directing JEP for the last 5 years of his life. And together they dedicated an annual memorial lecture in memory of the Rebbetzin's parents. And we certainly hope and pray that the neshamos of Lena Seiler and her husband will be elevated in the world of eternity. Seventy-two years ago, to be precise, as we commemorate Kristallnacht, Gestapo chief Heinrich Müller contacted all of the police stations throughout Germany with the following order. He explained to them that there was going to be a widespread action, a movement against the Jewish population, and this was going to be carried out by ordinary Germans. And the police were given direct, very clear orders not to interfere in any way. The Germans, who were, of course, very efficient, they also contacted the various fire departments. And the fire departments were told about the fact that synagogues would be set on fire and they should not respond to any call to, you know, deal with the emergency, with one exception. And that was if in case any of the buildings that would be burning would be attached to any Aryan property, so then they had to intervene. But other than that, they should stay aside. This night, of course, 72 years ago, came to be known as Kristallnacht, the night of shattered glass, for very good reason. We know that on this particular night, this night was sort of considered the formal start of the Holocaust. When I use the word formal, I'm referring to the fact that well before Kristallnacht, after 1933, when Hitler was democratically elected to be the Chancellor of Germany, there was already a great deal of persecution and beatings, and Jews were vandalized and in many cases killed. But the formal beginning of the Holocaust is considered to be Kristallnacht. On this particular night, 2,000 plus Jews were murdered, 30,000 Jews were deported and sent to concentration camps. Now, at that particular time, and actually well into the war, when a Jew was deported and he was told he was being resettled, a Jew did not know what that meant. They did not have any idea what fate awaited them. The Germans were very adept at trying to avoid any possibility of rebellion. So through a great deal of camouflage and subterfuge and outright lies, they disguised their intentions until it was impossible to do anything. So 30,000 Jews were deported. Almost 600 synagogues were burnt to the ground on this particular night. An additional 76 that were not burned were totally demolished. Thousands of Jewish businesses were destroyed. As a matter of fact, a woman who was here tonight told me that the jewelry shop that was owned by, I believe, her grandparents was ransacked, and the place was cleaned out, and all the jewelry was taken on Kristallnacht. I want you to know it wasn't on Kristallnacht, but my father, Olav HaShalom of blessed memory, he was a businessman. He had a men's clothing store in Germany, in the city of Villingen. And needless to say, he was left with nothing. There's only one thing that remains from that store in terms of Jewish ownership. This hanger hung in my father's store. It was common for store owners to print their name on the hanger to advertise their business. So this hanger says Felix Zajcek Villingen, and the type of business. And this is what, you know, this is all we got. That's all we got, is this one hanger. Now, I would like to mention that tonight our gathering here is more than just a memorial gathering. Actually, all of us tonight are here to participate in a very important mitzvah. You know, usually when we go to a lecture, we don't think in terms of, you know, sitting and listening to a lecture as some kind of a mitzvah. But there's a special mitzvah that we are fulfilling tonight. Towards the end of the book of Deuteronomy, towards the end of the book of Devarim, in Parshas Ki Tzetzeh, the Torah states, Zochar Asher Oseh Lecha Amolek. Remember what Amolek did to you. Amolek was the individual who was the rabid anti-Semite who led an army that as soon as our people left Egypt, while they were weak and defenseless after 210 years of enslavement and torture in Egypt, that he felt was the best time to strike and nip the problem of Jewish existence right in the bud. And he made the first determined attempt to find the final solution to the Jewish problem. Baruch Hashem, the fact that we are here tonight testifies that he was not successful. But this was, in fact, his goal. In the 1600s, there lived a rabbi whose name was Rav Yaakov Emdin. He, in fact, wrote a very famous commentary on our prayer book. And Rav Yaakov Emdin, a great sage, stated the following. He put this in writing. He warned the Jewish people to be very, very cautious with regard to Germany. And he stated that the people of Germany are in fact descendants of Amalek. And of course, that's what he stated in the 1600s. Just how he figured that out, it's not so clear to me, but the Nazis and the German people who were behind the Nazis, they made it very clear that his theory was quite right. By the way, I would like to mention that I have a sister who visited Germany in the 1980s, and she went to Villingen. She wanted to find the area where my father had his business. And she asked around, and she was able to narrow down to just a few stores the spot where my father had his business. But she couldn't, you know, hit the nail on the head. She didn't know what to do. So she decided to stop an old fellow who was walking by on the street. She figured, who knows, maybe he was around at that time. This was in the 1980s. And she my sister speaks some German, and she asked this guy, you know, did you know this in the store? And she mentioned our father's name. And this was in the winter, by the way. So the guy looks at my sister and said, you see this coat that I'm wearing? I bought it from your father. My father always believed in very excellent quality. And while my sister was there, she met with the mayor of a town next to the small town where my mother grew up, my mother of blessed memory. And the mayor, he was trying to be very friendly and very accommodating, though. So what a wonderful, lover of Jews that he is. He showed my sister the records that he kept in his home of the Jewish families and their ancestry dating all the way back to the 1600s. That's when Rav Yaakov Emden made his comment about, the 1600s. He said, be careful with regard to Germany. They were already keeping records. They didn't have a big problem when it came to, the time when they wanted to find out where to find the Jews. They knew exactly where to go. So I want you to know, I mean, obviously you can see that I have this is a topic that I'm very intimately connected with. I would like to share with you a story about two women. They lived in different parts of Germany. One woman's name was Emmy. She lived in a town called Hagen, which is in Westphalia, in a portion of the Black Forest. And, she and her parents and her siblings, when this was in 1938, when the storm clouds were gathering, nobody knew exactly what was going to happen, but it looked very, very bleak. And unfortunately, most German Jews were not, and this is true, of course, of most European Jews, most German Jews were not in a position to leave Germany unless they could find someone to guarantee their financial security. Thanks to FDR and Joe Kennedy, this was the policy of the United States government. There were, relative to the number of Jews who wanted to emigrate to the United States, only a fraction of Jews actually were able to do so. You had to have somebody, not everybody has a relative in America who's willing to underwrite their financial security. So this particular woman, Emmy, she didn't have anybody, her family didn't have anybody, they didn't know just how she was going to leave. But then this lady, Emmy, she had an idea. She had a brother who was single, and she figured, he was still a bachelor, and she figured maybe she could do something to help her brother. So what did she do? She took out a personal ad in a German newspaper in which she stated that there's a young man who is single, he's seeking matrimony, and if there's a young lady who perhaps has papers to be able to come to the United States. It was life and death then. She wanted to save her brother. That was the main objective over here. She wanted to see him married too, but she wanted to see what she could do to get him out of Germany. So this other lady that I had in mind, whose name was Ilse, she lived in a different part of Germany. She lived in a town called Karbach, which is in a section of Germany known as Bavaria. So she read this, this advertisement, this personal ad, and she herself was a woman who was married. She had three children. She had a sister who was single. So she had a good idea. She figured she'll respond to the ad. Her sister didn't have papers yet, but she knew she might be able to get papers. So she responded to the ad. And as a result of this, these two individuals, the brother and the sister, the brother of Emmy and the sister of Ilse, they met and they were married. Now, this is a very important story to me personally, because the couple that got married as a result of this were my parents. And unfortunately, Emmy never lived to get married herself because the Nazis murdered her. Unfortunately, Ilse, her husband, and their three children were all murdered by the Nazis as well. But their act of chesed, Emmy and Ilse's act of chesed, accounts for our being able to be here tonight together. Baruch Hashem. So their memory should be blessed. I do want to say that, you know, in the work that I do, I on a regular basis, I do feel that whatever measure of success I have in the work that I'm doing in terms of Jewish outreach is based upon the fact that I am working on top of the ashes of my ancestors, my the people who were murdered. When my wife and I got married, we got married out in Columbus, Ohio. We had 350 people at our wedding. Aside from my parents, only one was a relative of mine, a second cousin once removed. So, and not only that, but my father, Olav HaShalom, my father of blessed memory, he was one of nine children. And I'm the only male to be born from all nine children, thanks to the Nazis. So I personally feel that I have a responsibility on my shoulders to try to keep what they lived for going. And of course, we all want to share that feeling together, and we realize that whether our ancestors were direct victims or not, but we collectively, as members of Klal Yisrael, as members of the Jewish people, we have a responsibility to keep going what these wonderful people perished for. Now, I would like to suggest that our being here tonight on the occasion of Kristallnacht has particularly great significance because of the age that we live in. We know that it's not just a question of people's memories fading, but we are all well aware of the fact that there are many Holocaust deniers who, they are very convincing. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that there are many young Jews out on college campus, very liberal-minded Jews, who are taken in by the claims of these very prolific speakers and their arguments. There are many, many young Jews, and sometimes not such young Jews, who buy into the idea that, yes, the Jewish people, they are overstating this problem of the Holocaust. It never really happened that way. We're distorting history because we want to win the sympathy of the world. We wanted to be able to do what we want in terms of our aggression in the Middle East, in terms of establishing Israel. So the best way to do that was to pull the wool over the eyes of the Gentile world to arouse their sympathies. So in a time when you have all of this Holocaust denial going on, I think it's especially important for us to get together and to, put on center stage what it is that happened. I started to mention earlier the fact that tonight we're here to perform a mitzvah. The mitzvah is to remember what Amalek did to you. We got to remember that. Now, it's very interesting to note that the Torah doesn't just say, remember what Amalek did to you. The Torah adds two words. The Torah says, Al tishkach. Don't forget. Now, you are probably aware, if you have a connection to Torah study, that there are no extra words in our Torah, which is a divine document. That being the case, whenever we come across anything in the Torah that seems to be redundant, we have a right to stop to ask, what's going on over here? Stop the music. What do we have to have this for? So that when the Torah says, remember what Amalek did to you. So, obviously, that means we're not supposed to forget. So, if the Torah is telling us to remember, why does the Torah have to add the words, Al tishkach, don't forget? So, the Rambam, Maimonides, tells us the following. He says, when the Torah tells us, don't forget, that refers to the fact that we're supposed to keep alive in our heart, in our memory bank, a clear awareness of what happened. Not only are we supposed to remember what happened, but the Rambam says we even have an obligation to keep alive the enmity for the perpetrators of this evil. We're not just trying to remember an unfortunate part of history, but we're supposed to, you know, we're not supposed to in any sense be forgiving or turn the other cheek, or we're supposed to really keep alive that the appropriate enmity for such vicious individuals as the Germans and all of their cohorts were. So says the Rambam, when the Torah says, don't forget, that makes it clear that we got to keep the memory alive. So why does the Torah have to also say, remember? Says the Rambam that it's not enough to just think about it. We got to speak about it openly. That's what we're here to do tonight. We are here to openly discuss what happened and hopefully draw some very important insight from our discussion. And I would like to point out that, surmise, this is a subject that, I spend a lot of time with, not only in terms of reading up on it, but in my thought process. The most difficult part of my preparing my remarks this evening was in choosing what to leave out. That was very difficult for me, because there's a lot to talk about when, you know, the Holocaust can be discussed from many, many different angles. For one thing, we could spend our time tonight discussing the bestiality of the Nazis, the horrendous, indescribable atrocities that they committed. To be able to understand the level of their evil. That's one possibility, but I decided, as you'll see in a moment, I decided to choose a different topic. Another possibility, instead of talking about the question of the Nazis' bestiality, we could talk about the indifference that the world showed towards the fact that Jews were being murdered. And by the way, this indifference was something that had very far-reaching practical repercussions. Because the Germans, they were very, very interested in knowing whether or not the world, would the world tolerate what Hitler wrote in his Mein Kampf that he was planning to carry out? Would the world stand for such a thing? Perhaps the world would be so outraged that there would be a not just a moral outcry, but everybody would band together and stop them from doing this. So actually, when the Nazis started to carry out their atrocities, they were tuned in to observe, you know, what are the French saying, and what are they saying in America, and, you know, all the different countries. And it became very clear to Adolf Hitler in short order that the world really didn't care. You know what one of the test situations was that convinced Adolf Hitler that he could go ahead with his plans without any hesitation whatsoever? If you remember, there was a ship that was packed with almost 1,500 Jews, the St. Louis, and this ship left Germany, and the ship sailed to numerous countries, and it was very clear what the fate of the people, the Jewish passengers on the ship, was to be. And they went from port to port. They made it as far as Cuba. Finally, they got to just outside of Miami. And the ship was in the harbor for 3 days. And all kinds of pressure was applied on the American government. And in the final analysis, the American government, under the leadership of FDR, said, "We don't want these Jews. Send them back. They had no place to go." So where did they go? They went back to Germany. And most of the passengers on the ship were, of course, exterminated by the Nazis. So we have to realize that when we talk about indifference to evil, it's important to realize that when someone is indifferent to evil, they become a partner in that evil. I think it's fair to say that much of the so-called civilized world were partners in the devastation and horror that occurred to our people because of the fact that they really did not care. Today people are forgetting, you know, you know, it's harder to find, you know, survivors today. You know, their time has come. They're passing away. You know, it used to be a lot easier to find Jews with numbers on their arms. It's not so easy anymore. You know, there was one particular fellow who was a survivor of the concentration camps. And after he got out, you know, after the war was over, he said to himself, look, I went through 6 years of the worst nightmare. Maybe it'll be possible for me to live out the rest of my lives in comfort. So what did he do? He went and he bought himself a lottery ticket. And he was hoping that, I went through so much, I'm going to buy this lottery ticket, maybe I'm going to really hit the jackpot and I'll win. He bought the lottery ticket and he did not win. But, you know, he had this idea, he had this dream in mind. So, you know, on a weekly basis, he would buy a lottery ticket. And he did this for years. Finally, after many, many, many years went by, he finally hit the jackpot. This guy won the lottery. He became a multimillionaire. He was very philanthropically inclined. He gave out a tremendous amount of tzedakah. And you know something? He sent a $1 check to the American Nazi Party. I see you look puzzled. Mm-hmm. So was everybody who heard about this. So one of this guy's friends, who I heard about what he did, he said, why in the world would you send a dollar to the American Nazi Party? So he rolled up his sleeve and he showed him the number on his arm and he said, every time I bought a lottery ticket, I always played this number. So I guess he enclosed a little note to the attention of the American Nazi Party saying he thinks he owed him at least that much. But it's harder to find the numbers today. So we have to emblazon the numbers in our memory bank. The subject that I have decided to discuss tonight is the subject of the spiritual heroism of our Jews who went through the Holocaust. And I'm going to tell you why I chose this particular topic. Twice a week, on Monday and on Thursday morning, during the Shachris service, we say a elongated prayer for forgiveness called Tachanun. And in this prayer, only on Monday and Thursday, we recite the following words. Habet, we're talking straight to the Almighty when we say this prayer. And we say, Habet mishamayim ura'ei. We say to God, God, look from the heavens and see. Ki hoyinu lagvo kelos bagayim. Look, we've become a mockery. We've become a disgrace among the Gentile nations of the world. Nechavnu katzon latevach, Yuval. We're like sheep led to slaughter. And by the way, this is not a euphemism. There was a town in Europe which had a slaughtering house. And one night, the Nazis gathered up all of the Jews in this town, and they brought them to the Schlachthaus. They brought them all to the slaughtering house. I'm not going to go into detail of what they did, but you can figure out what they did in the slaughtering house. We say to Hashem, Hashem, we're taken out like sheep to be slaughtered. Laro, that we should die. Ula Abed, we should be destroyed. Ula Maka, we should be beaten. Ula Chepa, we should be put to shame. Now here's the punchline. We went under the mill in the worst possible way. Uvechol zos, despite everything. Shimcha lo shachachnu, we did not forget your name. We remembered your name, Hashem. We remembered our commitment to you. We did not throw away our allegiance to you as a people. And in that merit, final two words, what do we say to Hashem? We say, final three words, no al tishkochenu. We say to God, God, we didn't forget you. Please, God, don't forget us. Please don't forget us. Now, what are we looking for when we want God to remember us? We're interested in being able to get to the point of history which Jews have been davening for thousands of years. The point of the Geula Shleima, the final redemption of our people. And we're saying to Hashem, look, Hashem, we may not have the merits. Maybe we as a people, we may not be where we need to be in terms of meriting the final redemption. But Hashem, look at our people. Look at the fact. Look what we've gone through. Look at the pain. And we're still with you, Hashem. We still identify ourselves as Jews who believe in you and who are committed to you. So I would like to suggest that when we talk about the topic of the spiritual heroism that was shown during the Holocaust, it's important to realize that we have an opportunity to evoke divine mercy. That's what we're trying to do. Actually, there are multifaceted benefits of trying to dwell on this particular topic. But one of them is we would like to bring to light and remind ourselves, and we want to say to Hashem, Hashem, we're here, Hashem. We're with you, Hashem. Please don't forget us, Hashem, in the merit, in the schus of what these people went through. In addition, we want to be able to gain inspiration. We're going to talk about examples of spiritual heroism, some of which I think we'll find very, very moving. And we'll have an opportunity to introspect and to consider, you know, how we can use these unbelievable examples for personal inspiration. We want to also elevate the neshamos, the departed souls of those who were murdered. That's certainly a very important benefit. And in addition, one final benefit, and that is we'd like to dispel the common misconception that's out there, not only in the Gentile world, but in much of the Jewish world. Which misconception am I referring to? They went like sheep. They went like sheep is one of the ugliest and greatest lies that is being told in the modern world today. It's very important to understand that the conditions under which the Jews were brutalized made it impossible for them to do anything. There were rare moments of physical resistance. There was, for example, in the Warsaw Ghetto, which we're all familiar with, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, there was a rabbi, one of the few rabbis who, until the time that he was murdered, were still in a position of responsibility. Actually, this man, Rabbi Menachem Ziemba, word was gotten to him that people that, you know, who were outside of Poland were willing to intervene. They were able to bribe the right people, and it's a great mitzvah to be able to save a great sage. You know, he could provide leadership to the Jewish people in the future. So they told Rav Menachem Ziemba that we got a way to get you out of here. Rav Menachem Ziemba refused to leave. He felt that my place is to be here until the last moment with my brethren, and he didn't go anywhere. And he was murdered, you know, in the Warsaw Ghetto. And I want you to know something. Jews in the ghetto who looked to Rav Menachem Ziemba for leadership, they came and they asked him when the end was obviously coming closer and closer, and the question of a rebellion came up. So one thing was very clear, that if they were going to rebel, they were going to hasten their death. And we know that in Jewish law, even if it appears that someone is going to be dying, we are not permitted to hasten their death. If somebody is on a respirator, God forbid, and they have a terminal illness, we are not allowed to pull out the plug. Sometimes we don't always put the plug in. Depends on the situation. I'm not getting into that tonight. But if a person is on a respirator, we are not permitted to, even though the conditions may be very difficult, we're not allowed to hasten their demise. So there were Jews who came to Menachem Ziemba and said, look, we want to do whatever we can to take as many of these German beasts down. But we realize that is only going to hasten our own death. So they ask a shaila. They ask him, are we allowed to rebel or not? So Rav Menachem Ziemba stated, and he encouraged everybody to rebel. And he explained to them that rebellion would be a Kiddush Hashem. It would be a sanctification of God's name. And it would be a Milchemes Mitzvah. It would be a war, a battle, which in itself was a mitzvah. So because of what, partly a large extent, because of what Rav Menachem Ziemba had to say, the Jews of Warsaw, they did rebel. And of course, we know that they had very limited, short-lived success. But they did make a very great Kiddush Hashem. People are still talking about the Warsaw Ghetto uprising to this very day. But let's understand something. When people talk about the idea that they went like sheep, let's realize that if somebody was taken prisoner or sent wherever they were told to go under the very efficient system of German brutality, they there was no choice. There's nothing you could do. You know, you had these guys standing around with machine guns, and you had the German shepherds, and the plans weren't clear. And, you know, when you're in a tough situation, you hope things are going to get better. And, you know, for example, in Hungary, you know, when the Jews from Hungary were shipped to Auschwitz, when they got to Auschwitz, the Germans handed out postcards. And they told everybody to write on the postcards, you know, hi, we're here, everything's okay. Because they didn't want the Jews, who they still look forward to transporting to Auschwitz and gassing, they did not want them to have a clue. And people, you know, nobody wants to believe that the worst thing is going to happen. You know, we live in a world today, everybody's talking about, you know, Ahmadinejad. He's getting ready to nuke Israel. He's getting ready to nuke, Western countries. How many people are willing to believe that? How many people would rather say, this guy's a crackpot, that's just propaganda, you really believe what he's going to say? People don't take him seriously. So there are a lot of people, they just didn't know until it was too late. They just had no idea. So first of all, we need to understand that physical resistance was almost 100% impossible. But what was possible, and what was something that the Jewish people demonstrated an unbelievable strength in, was in the area of spiritual heroism. The way they stood up under the most impossible conditions, and they resisted the Germans. I would like to mention a number of incidents that I think are worthy of our attention. One particular facet that the Germans were known for, they still have a reputation for that down to this very day. If you want to think about buying a BMW, the Germans are known, they're known for what? They were known as being into Blitzsauber. I will translate what that means. That means things have to be as neat as a pin. Everything has to be, done just right. Okay, no loose ends. Okay, the trains have to leave on time for the crematoria. No messing around. They had their system. So it's important to realize that part of this German mentality, that everything had to be neat as a pin, that meant that every atrocity that the Jews were interested in carrying out it had to be something that was acceptable within the framework of German law. No problem. So what Germany did was to legalize illegality. That's exactly what they did. For example, on May 7th, 1942, rather than just go out and, into Kovna, for example, the city of Kovna, the Germans decided they wanted to kill all the Jewish babies. So rather than just go around and shoot Jewish babies, what did they do? They said, well, we got to make a law. We got to make it legal. So they made a law. On May the 7th, 1942, the Germans passed a law that it is illegal for a Jewish woman to give birth to a child. And if a Jewish woman would dare give birth to a child, that the consequence of that would be that the baby and the mother would be shot. No questions asked. That was the law. You understand? So, and it didn't make a difference whether a woman was already pregnant or not, right? It was illegal to give birth to a child. So you can imagine in the city of Kovna, if a Jewish woman was pregnant, you can imagine the terror that filled her heart. I would like to tell you about the birth of one particular Jewish baby. There was a fellow there named Yitzhak Blach, and he and his wife were childless for 5 years. And finally, they had a child. And you understand that we have a child, but go say Mazel Tov in a situation like that. So they had a big problem because how are they going to keep this kid? Oh, by the way, Reverend Ephraim Oshri, who was a rabbi in Kovna, he was one of the very, very few rabbis who survived the war. Reverend Ephraim Oshri testifies that we should know that the Jewish mothers who were pregnant did not perform abortions. They said, look, we're not going to be the ones responsible for the death of our children that we're carrying. They would not perform abortions. And this one couple, they had this child. And what happened was like this. They decided there was an area, like there was a trade school in Kovna that had machines. So this couple decided that they would move into the trade school so that when the machines were running, at least then, the Germans would not be able to hear the baby crying. So the eighth day came and it was time to have a bris. I go have a bris in the Kovna, in the Kovna ghetto. So they gathered a small group of people and they brought a mole and they were ready to start the bris. And all of a sudden they heard the shrieking sounds of the German Gestapo sirens. And they realized that what was happening now, and they realized the Germans were about to enter. And everybody started, they were in pandemonium, they were, what's going to happen now, and they didn't know what to do. It was an impossible situation. There was one loud voice that was louder than all of the other voices in that mass confusion. And that was the voice of the mother, who screamed out, quick, quick, do the bris now, do the bris now, at least we should die as a Jew. So very quickly the bow went and he did the bris. Fortunately at that moment, even though the benefits were only temporary, the Germans in fact did not come in. They just made a peripheral inspection. They didn't come into the actual room. Of course, most of the people there were eventually murdered. But if we think about the fact that what meant so much to this Jewish mother and to this Jewish father, that my child has to be part of the Jewish people. He has to be part of Klal Yisrael. It's hard to understand the depth of connection that an ordinary Jew could have to Hashem under these nightmarish conditions. There was a fellow who survived the war, whose name was Joseph Friedenson. Joseph Friedenson actually has been a very important witness. He put in writing a great deal of what he experienced in the concentration camps. And Joseph Friedenson was an inmate in Block 22 of Auschwitz. And in the morning, when he would be woken up early in the morning, he was given, along with the other inmates who went out to do backbreaking labor the entire day, he was given a very small piece of bread. And you had to run. You had to run out there, and you had to be at the inspection, you had to be at the head count, and you went straight from having, the inspection, you went straight to the place where you're going to work. So this guy, as hungry as he was running and racing, had to get there on time. And if you don't get there on time, forget about it. He was racing. And what did he forget? He forgot that little piece of bread. Forgot his piece of bread. And he spent the entire day, in starvation, doing this back-breaking work. And he knew that at night there was no food. That was the only food they got the entire day. So he had to be, all day long he was doing his back-breaking work. He was totally famished. He was hardly able to stand. There's nothing to look forward to at night. Finally, after his entire, the day goes by, what happens? He comes back to block 22, and a fellow walks over to him. His name was Reb Binyamin. Reb Binyamin was a Jew who somehow was able to smuggle a pair of tefillin into block 22 of Auschwitz. Nobody knew how he did it. And he used to get up at, like, super early in the morning, and he used to put on his tefillin. Reb Binyamin walks over to Joseph Friedenson, and he said, "I think this might be yours." And he gives him the piece of bread. And he explained to him that after he left in the morning, he found the piece of bread, and he wasn't sure who it belonged to. He wasn't sure if it belonged to Joseph Friedenson, or if it belonged to a Polish individual who was a Gentile, who was also an inmate in Auschwitz. And you understand they didn't have any big breakfast over there in Auschwitz. So whatever little he had, he was still hungry. And he had this extra piece of bread now. So he said he spent the entire day agonizing over what to do with the piece of bread. Should I eat the piece of bread? It's a piece of bread. It's like, we're thinking about an old crusty piece of bread. That meant more to a starving Jew than if you think about a five-star restaurant and your favorite dinner. A broken crust of bread when you're starving means everything. And all day long he was, "What should I do? What should I do? What should I do?" And he said, "I'm so glad you're back, because I succeeded in saving this piece of bread for you." And he said, "I didn't know." He said, "I figured maybe it's yours. And if it's yours, so I wanted you to have it. And in case it belongs to the Gentile, that's okay too. Let him see what a Jew who gets up early in the morning to put on tefillin, let him see what kind of human being he is." And he gave him the piece of bread. I think one thing that is important to appreciate is the fact that while the Germans tried very, very hard to destroy any kind of loyalty between one Jew and another, as a matter of fact, the Germans tried their very best to try to get Jews to turn on one another. And that's one of the reasons why they appointed the Kapos. They put in place a system so that any sense of camaraderie between a Jew and Jew was something that they were trying to undermine. But many, many, many Jews, countless numbers of Jews, demonstrated unbelievable devotion to their fellow Jew. As a matter of fact, one of the people who was an inmate at a concentration camp, a very famous individual, Viktor Frankl, he was the father of a school of psychology known as logotherapy, and he did a study about how it is that people were able to survive under the unbearable conditions of the Holocaust. And he came out with a very interesting conclusion. He said what he noticed when he was in concentration camp was that those Jews who were willing to share their rations with other Jews had a higher rate of survival. Those Jews who were, understandably less inclined to share, right, not being judgmental, but those Jews had a lower survival rate. Being devoted to others gives a person a purpose and a reason to keep on going, not to throw in the towel. As a matter of fact, Viktor Frankl wrote a very famous book called The Meaning of Life. The Search for Meaning in Life. A very excellent book. I highly recommend it. Now, also, there was I think the name Gideon Hausner might be familiar to many of you. Gideon Hausner wrote an extensive work called Justice in Jerusalem about the trial of Adolf Eichmann. And he wrote down, he put in print a lot of the different testimony that was stated at the trial of Eichmann. And Gideon Hausner wrote about the trial of a fellow named Zalman Kleinman. Zalman Kleinman was at the trial, and he spoke about the time that he was in the children's block of Auschwitz. While he was in the children's block of Auschwitz, one time when he was lying on his board over there, One time, a Gestapo officer walked in with a heavy rubber hose, and it was clear that he was coming to beat someone. And everybody was looking, who's next? And he walked over to a 14-year-old kid, and he started beating him mercilessly. And the general number of blows that was given, meted out by an officer, was 25. But while he was beating this kid, there was not a whimper. There was not a cry. You couldn't hear a sound. He kept on beating him. He finally turned him over. I'll spare you the details. It was horrible. Finally, the guy walks out, and this fellow who testified at the trial of Adolf Eichmann, Zalman Kleinman, he walks over to this poor 14-year-old kid, and he said, "What did you do? What did you do?" He said, "I smuggled a few sidurim into my friends." And he said, "And it was worth it. It was worth it." See, if we look at this kind of dedication, see, these are not just interesting stories. These are inspirational stories. When we look at a 14-year-old teenager in Auschwitz being beaten, who expresses this idea, who has this kind of devotion to what a mitzvah to be able to daven to Hashem, "I got the worst beating in the world possible, full of scars and blood. It was worth it to bring a few sidurim to my friends." Maybe when we daven, if we remember this young man, maybe when we daven, it could help us a little bit to get into it a little bit more. If we can picture his devotion, his dedication, and you know, sometimes, daven a little bit more, a little bit less, you know what I mean? If we realize davening is beautiful, davening is an opportunity, it's a privilege, it's something that we have to value, it's something we have to cherish. Look how this young, look how a 14-year-old kid, how he cherished what it means to daven from the Siddur. If we understand that, we can do more than just say, "Wow, that was a great kid." But we can, as I mentioned earlier, we're trying to inspire ourselves by recalling these different examples of spiritual heroism. I'm going to curtail because of the hour. I'm going to leave out some of what I wanted to share with you, but a couple of things I have to mention. There were some very fascinating questions that were posed by ordinary Jews during the Holocaust. And the questions, you know, in Jewish life, it's important to, you know, as I often mention in my classes, it's very important to consult with a Torah guide. But, you know, the questions come up in life. You know, real, not just like, you know, questions about technicalities, but questions about how to conduct our lives. So it's very important to have a Rebbe, very important to have somebody that one turns to for guidance in terms of how to figure out the Torah solution. Let's look at some of the questions that were asked by Jews who lived through this nightmare. There was a day, October 29th, 1941, in the city of Kovna. It was called the Black Day. The Hebrew date was the 8th of Mar Cheshvan. On that particular day, 30,000 Jews were forcibly gathered, surrounded by Gestapo SS guards with the machine guns. They were all brought to a central area, and it was very clear to them what was going to happen. There was going to be a selection, and there was one fellow who was in the crowd whose name was Eliyahu. And Eliyahu, this young man, realized that by the next day, most of those 30,000 Jews would be dead. He understood that, and that is in fact what happened. There was an area right outside of Kovna that had been built decades earlier by the Russians, called the Ninth Fort. And the Ninth Fort was a place where the most unimaginable atrocities were committed. This young man, Eliyahu, came to this rabbi that I mentioned earlier, Rabbi Ephraim Oshri, and he asked him the following question. He said, "We know, Rabbi, that there's a mitzvah in the Torah of Kiddush Hashem, of sanctifying one's name for God." And he said that if a Jew is about to become a martyr, there's a bracha. There's a bracha. And he said, "Rabbi Oshri, I'm not sure what the right bracha is." You know, when we make, we have different brachas that we say. Sometimes we use the infinitive form of a word, like when the bracha that we make before the, blessing the Shabbos candles, we say, Lahadlik Nashel Shabbos, to light the Shabbos candles. That's the infinitive form of the word. But sometimes we say, we don't use the infinitive form, like when we wash our hands before bread. We say, Al Netilas Yadayim, upon the washing of the hands. We don't use the infinitive form. So this guy, this Eliyahu, he comes over to Ephraim Ushri and he says, Rabbi, what's the proper wording? If they're going to kill me, should I say the bracha, Al Bracha to Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Hashekin Shonu B'Mitzvos V'Lev Tzivonu, Al Kiddush Hashem, upon the sanctification of God's name, or the Kaddish es Hashem, or to sanctify God's name. He wanted to get the bracha right. It's unbelievable. A Jew facing death. It's a very tough time. He's in pain. He's filled with terror. What is on his mind? He's got to have one mitzvah to do just before he leaves this world. One mitzvah. He wants to get it right. He wants to say the bracha right. What shall we say? What shall all of us say when we hear about this type of... These are part of our people. This is who we come from. We have to know we come from great stock. We come from a Klal Yisrael, a holy people. The neshama, the soul of a Jew comes... we respect all human beings, and we understand that all human beings are created in the image of God. But we do know that while all human beings are endowed with a soul, a Jewish soul comes from a special warehouse. And we have to know that we are in possession of a neshama, one of these special souls. It's only a special neshama that comes from that kind of a warehouse that can care about what bracha to say before a person leaves this world. I'm going to tell you about one more question. I'm going to fast forward. Believe it, I'll tell you the truth, it's very hard for me to leave out some of these questions because they're unbelievable questions. I want you to know something. I want you to know where these questions came from. I told you this fellow, Rav Ephraim Ushri. So when he was in the Kovna ghetto, Jews came over to him and they asked him questions. So he wrote down the questions on little scraps of paper and he stuck them into empty, broken down, crushed metal cans. And he buried them under the ground. And he figured like this, I'm probably never going to survive the war. But who knows? In case I survive, I'm going to come back and I'll dig up the cans. So he came back. He survived. He was one of the only rabbis, really, he was one of the only rabbis to survive. Because the rabbis were at the top of the list of who the Nazis wanted to destroy. After the war, he came back. He dug up the cans. And you know what he did with those little pieces of paper? He published 4 books in Hebrew. And a woman condensed all 4 of them into one book called Responsa from the Holocaust. I read about the Holocaust a lot, and I'm really, as I'm into the topic. But in my humble opinion, the one book about the Holocaust that's at the top of the list in terms of what every Jew should read is this particular book, a responsa from the Holocaust. She condensed the question, she gave the background information that the question was asking, and what Rav Ephraim Ushri had to say. It's a good idea, by the way, if you read the book, to read the question and don't read the answer. Try to figure it out on your own and then read the answer. It's a very fascinating book. And I'm going to tell you about an impossible question that was asked. But this question was asked of a rabbi named Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Meislish. There was a fellow who came over to Rabbi Meislish, and he said, Rabbi Meislish, I have a question for you. He says, there's a group of 1,400 young Jewish men who were just cordoned off by the Nazis in a special, separate, enclosed area. And I know that all 1,400 of them are about to be murdered. I know they're about to be murdered. And my son is in this group. And Rabbi Meislish, I'm in a position to bribe one of the guards, and I can get my son out of this group with the 1,400 men that are going to be murdered. So Rabbi Meislich says, that's wonderful. What's your problem? My problem is that I know how efficient the Nazis are. And if they're planning to exterminate 1,400 Jews, and I take out my son, and there's only 1,399 in there, I know that another Jew will be taken and executed as a result of my saving my son. Rabbi, is it permissible for me to save my son? Rabbi Meislich looked at this guy, and he said to him, please don't ask me that question. Please don't ask me that question. He says, but Rabbi, I'm asking a rabbi. I have to know what to do, Rabbi. Please, I have to know what is Hashem, what is the right thing to do in this situation? He says, I don't have my books here. I can't answer your question. And the guy wouldn't answer the question. And his fellow said to Rabbi Meislich, Rabbi Meislich, I know that if you're not willing to give me an answer to my question, I know that it's a problem for me to save my son and indirectly cause the death of another Jew. And that this question, by the way, was asked on Erev Rosh Hashanah, on the eve of Rosh Hashanah. And he said, Rabbi Meislich, I want you to know that I'm not gonna bribe the guard and take my son out of that group of 1,400 young men. When we talk about what it means, you know, we're part of one people. We're really all together. We're not just a family in terms of my spouse, my kids, my brothers, my sisters, my relative, but we are one extended family. And, you know, there's one difference between the man who asked this question and Avram Avinu and Abraham. And the question is like, Abraham was asked by God to sacrifice his son, and he was willing to do it. And we read that on Rosh Hashanah. But at the last moment, God told Abraham, don't go ahead with it. That was the plan. He was just testing Avram. He didn't have to do it. This Jewish father did actually sacrifice his son. He sacrificed his son because he didn't want to have the blood of another Jew on him. The strength of the Jewish neshama is something that is impossible for us to fathom. I'm going to end with a quote from Adolf Hitler. It's a two-line quote from Adolf Hitler, but it might be the most important two lines that we hear this evening. When Adolf Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany on January 30th, 1933, he declared war on the Jewish people. And he actually addressed the Jewish people when he became the Chancellor. And he said the following, here I stand with my bayonets. There you stand with your law. We shall see which prevails. It's up to every single one of us in this room to determine who will ultimately prevail. I'd like to invite you all to, first of all, participate in the wonderful refreshments that Harvey and Harvey Ann have provided. Also, we have a website. You know, if you'd like to keep abreast of what's going on at JEPA, we have a lot happening on a weekly basis. Click on to jepofwestchester.com, and you can sign in for future emails about our upcoming events. We're having a very spectacular program, One Night of Hanukkah. I hope you'll be able to join us for that event. The mood will be very different from our mood tonight. It'll be hopefully a mood of great simcha, and we look forward to sharing the very special simcha of Hanukkah with you all. Thank you.